Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. Today we are back in Washington, D.C. We sit down with Omar Vargas, who was a great guy, works for a great company, 3M. 3M has tens of thousands of products, tens of thousands of employees. It was great to sit down with Omar. He has worked for a number of people whom you have heard of. Mr. Comey, he started his government career at the Justice Department. He worked for President Bush, obviously in the Justice Department, and has some interesting stories about interacting with President Bush, Karl Rove, and others. He has a great office in Washington, D.C. with a lot of pictures of these notable people in politics. And we just had a great chat with Omar, and I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. We're also going to have a contest this week. For those of you that give our show a 5-star rating and make a comment and take a picture, a snapshot of that, screenshot, and email it to hello@thelobbyingshow.com, we will pick one winner who will get a $50 gift certificate to the restaurant of their choice. So we could pick a restaurant, but if we picked a restaurant, it would be in Washington, D.C. or New York City. And you may be in Austin, Texas, or Sacramento, or Harrisburg, or Springfield, Illinois, or Tallahassee, Florida, or Albany, New York, or Boston. So if you give us a 5-star rating, make a comment, take a screenshot, email it to hello@thelobbyingshow.com, and we will pick one winner. We are sitting here on a sunny day in Washington, D.C., in the beautiful offices of 3M with Omar Vargas, the head of government relations, government affairs for 3M. And we are looking at many pictures of presidents, Jim Comey, one with Omar and Karl Rove. Looks like there's a joke being told or something. Mr. Ashcroft, Alberto Gonzalez. It's kind of like a who's who of Washington, Omar, here on your walls. That's quite impressive.
Yeah, I guess so. It's fun. I probably need more space in here to put a few more photos up, but I guess this is what we do in town, right? We love our jobs and try to capture it every now and then.
Well, I think it's great. And you also have overhanging on the your rack over there a lot of old convention passes.
Credentials. Yeah.
And a tie. I see one tie in case you get in a jam.
That's right. That's a commemorative tie from my days at the Violence Against Women office in the early 2000s, where I my first posting in the U.S. Department of Justice. And we did an event with Lifetime Television to commemorate Domestic Violence Awareness Month, which is October, by the way, and we're in that month now. And so it's a great tie, one of the most rewarding positions I've ever had or jobs I've ever had. And it's a great tie. So I keep it around as an emergency backup.
That's great. So that was your first stint at Department of Justice?
Correct.
Was that your first government job, Department of Justice?
That was. So I practiced law for a few years here in town, nothing too exciting, but got a call shortly after President Bush was elected. Mm-hmm. Was presented with an opportunity to go work with the administration. And so I did that. I took the jump, if you will, and I'm kind of happy about that. I've not returned to law firm life since.
It's been good. Yeah. So tell us about the different
positions
you had at the Department of Justice.
Sure. First one was the Violence Against Women office, counsel, yep. And special assistant policy person, really policy role in that post. And it was, as I mentioned a few moments ago, rewarding in the sense that we were taking the Violence Against Women Act and sort of trying to create new initiatives, policies. The president really wanted to do something big. I think if I remember the phrase, it was big ball, was a phrase often used in the administration. And so we thought through with a lot of other stakeholders, both in and out of government, about what can we do to really advance the agenda to prevent violence against women. And so, you know, I worked on staffing up and organizing, running the President's Advisory Council on Violence Against Women, and meeting celebrities like, I remember Michael Bolton, I think he was on the council, to other fantastic advocates in the field on domestic violence and sexual assault, victims advocates, policy makers from state and local government, passionate folks in corporate America that also worked on domestic violence issues. And we jointly, I can't forget the local prosecutors. I remember some of their names. I think a gentleman named Casey Gwynn from San Diego, if I've got that right.
Okay.
He helped us to develop a new initiative called the Family Justice Centers, which the president announced and launched at an East Room event. It's great, right? You take this idea, so these kernels of ideas, and you come up with them, and you put them on paper, and you build support for it, and then you go forward. So,
and it's announced at the White House.
And it's announced at the White House.
Pretty
and then,
neat.
Well, then you got to get it done,
right?
You got to make it happen.
Right.
And so that went forward, and I believe that continues to be a success today. I really haven't kept an eye on it. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
We worked on campus sexual assault matters, which is something I think about, you know, every time I read about an incident happening in some school here in the country.
And this is back in the early Bush administration.
Early 2000s.
Okay.
This is I joined in September 2001.
Okay.
So this is 2001-2002 time period. Start to pick up some work on the faith-based initiative and human trafficking and other types of victims of crime programs.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I worked, had the opportunity to work directly with our assistant attorney general at that division called Justice Programs, Deborah Daniels, who is presently in Indiana these days. And Deb Daniels was fantastic to work with. I really enjoyed it there. Working with her more broadly on law enforcement programs, assistance programs, and crime victim programs, and juvenile justice programs, and of course, human trafficking portfolio, which was developed there. It really became another passion of mine, and something that I also found incredibly rewarding in terms of the work that we did with some career prosecutors and out of the Civil Rights Division, and I mean, you know, great friends, in fact, friends to this day with two individuals who are really passionate about modern-day slavery or human trafficking work, and that's currently now Ambassador Lou Baca, who was named Ambassador on Human Trafficking during the Obama administration.
Okay.
And another gentleman, T. March Bell, who's another passionate advocate and colleague on these types of issues. So from there, I went to the Deputy Attorney General's office. Jim Comey was the DAG in those days, and I focused mainly on the faith-based initiative and implementation, outreach work.
And you were working for Jim Comey?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And that maybe about a year or so, 2004 time frame. And then from there, I went to the Civil Rights Division, really worked on human trafficking there and some other projects.
Okay.
And then I wasn't there for too long when Alberto Gonzalez became Attorney General. Then I moved over to the Intergovernmental and Public Liaison Office, where I worked on a variety of matters. My recollection is still, you know, with the civil rights community, faith-based community, immigration issues. And this was about 2006 when...
And you were the liaison to the Hill?
And no, not really liaison to the Hill, liaison to the public. So,
okay. So
stakeholders,
okay.
To DOJ. So I remember, you know, several conversations, interactions with the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Reverend Al Sharpton on satellite voting matters, post Katrina.
Okay.
So you know, this was really rich time, and I enjoyed it, learned a lot, and really keep those learnings and experiences with me today in terms of just, you know, trying to build coalitions and take ideas and make them happen, or try to at least.
Right. It must have been incredible working in that office, given the resources that you have and the issues you were working on.
Yeah, there were a lot. There were a lot. But, you know, we all worked hard. It was a big team. I think I look back on those years, and they were the best professional years of my life. We had a great set of colleagues. A lot of us have dispersed, you know, across Washington, D.C. and various positions. And, moved on into higher levels of government in corporate America. We've dispersed around the country.
Yep.
But every now and then it's fun to catch up with folks and see what each other's doing.
I bet. So let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in New Jersey.
Okay.
Born in Paterson, New Jersey.
Okay.
A childhood in a community just outside of Newark, New Jersey.
Okay.
Called Irvington.
Okay.
Those are my most formative years, and look back actually on them quite fondly. It's a We didn't have a lot of money growing up, and neither did anybody in our neighborhood, but we sure did have a good time. And I remember chatting with Jim Comey because There was one conversation we had where we connected. He used to play softball in on a set of fields that were also my little league fields. I think when he was at the New York U.S. Attorney's office.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, we had a small little world. I always enjoy talking about growing up in New Jersey. Then high school, we moved out to Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Fantastic community. We love it. My parents live there today, and we're home quite often.
Okay.
And, you know, I go back to the old gas station I used to work at. The bakery I used to work at isn't there anymore. So, you know, can't go back and get the donuts and things like that. But great town.
And you obviously did well because you went to Seton Hall.
Yes.
And what did you major at Seton Hall?
So Seton Hall, a great university, at least in my mind, mainly because that's where I met my wife. And in fact, tomorrow, Saturday, we are celebrating 28 years since she agreed to go out to lunch with me. So we skipped off the Seton Hall campus and had lunch in Newark, New Jersey, at a Spanish restaurant. And we have been together since.
That's great.
Yeah.
What did you order? Do you remember?
What do we? Oh gosh! Now you're putting me on the spot. It was probably some chicken and rice, for sure. But I majored in political science, and because of my wife's influence, I minored in Spanish literature and language. She was a Spanish literature major.
Okay.
So of course, I conveniently took a lot of classes with her. And oh, look at that! I've got a minor. And
yeah, those minors you kind of just fall into.
You get kind
it's
of
like you have four courses, and if you get two and, more, you get a minor.
And boom, there you go. Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And Seton Hall was also incredibly generous and to me in my future because they provided me with a full academic scholarship to attend the school. So everything completely paid for, and that wasn't just it. The scholarship. That was named in memory of Dr. Martin Luther King. So really quite a commitment by the school, and they still have that program today.
Okay.
So 30 years, maybe, I think we recently commemorated. But back to the school, the in addition to the generosity of the financial support, the scholarship money, I had great professors, especially in the poli-sci department, who actually were the folks who urged me to come to Washington, D.C. for the first time and take an internship here, and that's how I kind of caught the Potomac bug, or urged me to go work on a presidential campaign. Then it was a Clinton, Bush campaign season. And what else did I do? Another internship with the New Jersey government.
What was your first internship down here?
Here, actually, was lobbying for enactment of NAFTA with a coalition generated out of the, or run by the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Okay.
Worked very closely with the Business Roundtable and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And I remember the Clinton White House at that time was very involved, very engaged, a lot of companies. It was a truly memorable experience in terms of sort of the excitement, I guess, that only you can have if you're politically inclined,
yeah.
You know, about that legislative process and about
yeah.
what's needed, sort of the shoe leather that was put down on that. And I met some really interesting and fantastic individuals. I remember having spent quite a bit of time with Bill Richardson, then a member of Congress, and another one, Jim Colby, another member of Congress, who were really active on NAFTA. And just watching them operate, watching them act, watching them speak, and leverage sort of the, or bring together the policy and the political, and that advocacy to this day are things that I continue to sort of try and remember and think about, and you know, sort of put into the big mix of, you know, how do you become a good advocate, or how do you advocate well,
right,
on behalf of whatever issue it is that you're working on.
Right. And now NAFTA, after being somewhat quiet for 20 plus years, is now back in the headlines quite a bit.
That's right. That's right. I often look back at that experience in Washington, and the funny part is that I worked just around the corner from here.
Oh, really?
At that time.
And your internship?
My internship. You know, all the offices were just around the corner, and
yep.
So I was like, wow, man, how crazy life is that here we go, you know, 20 some odd years later, and you know, right back to kind of where it all started. It's like Groundhog Day. But and the debate, right? The issues that were
yeah.
debated then are the same issues debated today.
Yeah.
And now we have a new product, and so let's see how that goes.
Yeah. And then after Seton Hall, you got your law degree, or what'd you do after college?
That's right. So I, you know, I'm one of these geeky kids that you know, watch all these old lawyer movies on TV, and I said, well, I want to be a lawyer.
Isn't that why we all went to law school?
That's right, isn't that why? Yeah, but I really liked being in Washington as a result of that internship. So, I applied to a few other law schools outside of D.C., but I really wanted to come here. So, you know, the first one that took me, American, as soon as that letter came in, I was like, I'm going back to D.C. And so I went to American University's Washington College of Law, and at the same time, one of the dual degree programs, over at their international school, the School of International Service.
Oh, and, okay. I didn't realize you did it at the same time.
Same time, simultaneously. Okay. And so it was a lot of work. A lot of summers, more in the classroom or working or interning somewhere than it was kind of hanging out.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get it done.
And you, unlike many lawyers in Washington, are actually a real lawyer. You had some real clerkships. You clerked for Superior Court and then went on and clerked at the U.S. Court of International Trade.
That's right. So I had a mentor of mine who I still, connect with to this day, because I admired his career, right? The lawyer as well, super smart guy, but doing some great work in the areas of international public law and human rights and policy. And I said to him, I'd like to be like you. And he said, well, before you do that, you've got to cut your teeth as a lawyer so that, when you're 40 years old, you can look, at any other lawyer in the room and say, well, yeah, I was a lawyer once too, right?
Right.
That's what I focused on. So I knew I had to get into the courtroom. I also thought I'd grow up to be one day an international trade lawyer because of my lobbying experience on NAFTA.
Yep.
But, life takes different trajectories. Now, these days, I wouldn't call me to review a will or anything like that. But and certainly don't call me if you've got a major a commercial transaction that you need help with, because I'm not your guy.
Well, that's all right. So tell us what for the listeners that don't know, tell us about the U.S. Court of International Trade. What is it like? What does it do?
So that court reviews administrative decisions on customs matters and cases. Let's say, just put it in a nutshell, and it's really a step of review step. Trying to find the simplest way to describe it, but they'll review claims on
it's an appeal
on dumping, on duty impositions. Okay. It is part of the review process, and really gets into the nuts and bolts or mechanics of trade and customs law.
Okay,
I think the cases we had there were, I think, some steel ball bearing cases, maybe. I know fresh cut flowers and another steel case, which I think about the briefs I've read. Fresh cut flowers from, I think, Colombia it was. But, in
what
today's...
What was the issue?
I think the issue was...
Are they really fresh? How do they keep them fresh?
Airplanes. Or FedEx. I'm not really sure.
I think they're
very cool. They're refrigerated.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the supply chain, but I think the concern was the dumping of those flowers on the market, right? So the undercutting of the price. Whether they were, sold here at a fair price.
Yep.
They unfairly subsidized in some way. And but the steel cases there, taught me something, gave me some insight into the steel industry, which are some of the same issues that we have today. In terms of domestic steel producers, foreign steel producers, the trade in steel and aluminum pipes and aluminum and pipes and things like that. So it somehow it always feeds right back into, I think, things you learned years ago.
Yeah. And then you were you spent 3 years at Cooper and Kirk practicing law.
Correct. Those were those few years, worked with some, still today, the smartest lawyers that I know.
Are they a Washington based?
They're here. They're based here in town.
Okay.
They're not far. I think they're over on near DuPont Circle.
Okay.
And I'm reminded, actually, that I should probably check in with them every now and then with a partner there. We try to catch up and have lunch.
And it was from there that you went to the Department of Justice.
That's correct. So from there, moved over to DOJ.
Yep. And then when you left DOJ, what was your next stop?
So I actually thought in 2006 that I would probably shut the lights off at DOJ in terms of the Bush administration leaving, and then figure out what I'd do after that. Really wasn't sure. And then had the good folks at PepsiCo reach out to me. And at first I thought they were looking for references or other, you know, ideas, people to talk to about working with them and joining their team. And then I was kind of, oh, it's me. And anyway, we had a couple of great conversations and some fantastic people there. Larry Thompson was the general counsel at the time, former DOJ official as well, and Dan Bryant, who's now at Walmart, and I knew them, and they introduced me to Joan, who became my boss at the time, one of the best bosses I've ever had, Galen Reeser, and we had a great time working together, and those folks at PepsiCo, I think, really taught me how to lobby. I think, you know, I understood how you take policy and sort of be a part of the policymaking process, but it was the whole lobbying part that I needed to learn. I'd not spent, you know, a day working on Capitol Hill.
Yep.
I'd always kind of been around Capitol Hill, but never on it. And so different world, right? And it's not like I joined the lobbying world with a, you know, Rolodex of contacts on Capitol Hill. But you know, they taught me how.
And were you doing more federal or state or both?
So federal, mainly exclusively, kind of, you know, supported some of the international projects or matters from D.C. So working with the diplomatic community here, worked with think tanks and other trade associations and third-party allies on various matters.
Yeah.
Really got steeped in agriculture policy and worked with a couple of farm bill on a couple of farm bills, and you know, used to joke with my friends in the ag sector in those days because here's a kid from urban New Jersey, and what do I know about working on a farm bill? But
were some of the if you remember some of the issues that you had to deal with back then at Pepsi? What was anything like?
Some of the issues that continue today, I think some of the major challenges that we had and continue to be part of discussion is the role of food and beverages in one's diet and public health.
Yep.
And so as you can see, I still have my Pepsi can right here.
I do see that. Yep.
You know, it's a full calorie can, but, you know, with its little calorie count on there. So, you know, I know what I'm consuming, but I've still got my bottle of water right here, right? So it's all about balance. So I still remember my talking points.
very impressive.
But it's a great company with excellent leaders, and it was really tough to make the decision to not just leave Pepsi when was this? 2011, 2012 timeframe. You know, having a great time there. I'd been in Washington at that point for about 20 years. I remember my wife and I with our kids pretty young saying, well, you know, I thought we'd return to New Jersey one day, but that wasn't happening. So we're like, oh, I guess we're here for the rest of our lives. And then, boom, here you go. I get a fantastic offer from another great company, Praxair. And the decision was not just to leave Pepsi, but to then relocate to Connecticut and sort of do the commuting thing, right? Work at the company headquarters, which is based in Danbury.
Yep.
And fly to Washington as needed to do the government affairs work that needed to be done. And so, you know, big move. Can't believe we did it. But it was a fantastic decision. You see my Praxair truck, and these aren't props, right? I mean, I've had that there since coming to 3M, but I really did enjoy my time at Praxair. My family really torn because we loved being in Washington. My older two kids really remembered fondly living in being here in the D.C. area, but we also enjoyed Connecticut and our community of Ridgefield. So anyway, we took the move. We're back here, and we've been back for about a year.
Okay, so you have Praxair for about 5 years?
So 20 left in 2012 and joined here in January 2017.
Okay, and now you're here. And so tell us about your responsibilities now and about 3M.
So 3M, I've really had the pleasure of working with some great American companies, legendary. So 3M is really a fascinating company because I tell you, with every day I learn something new and something that's really cool about the company. And I'm like Cliff in Cheers, right? I love just having kind of various, you know, random facts in my mind so that I can bring them forth at the most opportune and entertaining time. And 3M lets me do that, which is with things that we have and products and in the business. And actually reminds me, my dad's an engineer, and I remember my dad, actually, not even, he still does it from time to time, is he'll come home or tell me about this great product from 3M, especially on the adhesive side. And so, you know, it's fascinating now to kind of come back and work with an iconic company such as 3M.
Well, I'm sure there's not many people that don't have the 3M stickers in their office.
That's right.
I mean, it's and is it true that that was an accident? It was a glue that was being made for something else, and it was kind of a leftover.
Right. So I think, you know, there are lots of stories on so many different innovations and inventions that 3M has.
We don't do a lot of fact checking. You can tell us whatever story you want.
That's right. But no, and I have, you know, my post-it pad right here. It's like this is a commercial for any number of things here. But you know, at 3M there is actually a culture of innovation, and you know, a lot of companies have their unique cultures, and we can go on and on about the cultures of various organizations I've worked with. But in 3M, when they talk about the culture of innovation, it is real. And so whether it's a post-it note or some other product that's been developed, there are super smart people, a lot smarter than me, who are thinking creatively and scientifically about what is that next great thing? What is something that a consumer needs, whether it's an industrial consumer or a personal individual consumer.
And about how many products does 3M manufacture? Do you have any? I mean, it must be...
Gosh, well...
And
you know, was it 50,000, 55,000 products, I believe is what we have.
How many employees?
Well, it's right outside my office here. 91,000 employees around the world.
Wow.
We have about 35,000 of them in the United States.
Where's your headquarters in the U.S.?
We're headquartered in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay.
And we have operations in several states around the country, mainly in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a Midwest culture
and
style to the company.
Mm-hmm.
But our manufacturing is not just in the Midwest or Upper Midwest. We have operations in the South, like in Texas and Alabama, here on the East Coast. We operate around the world.
And do you have to do a lot of traveling for your job?
I do. I do quite a bit of traveling, whether it's headquarters in Minnesota or it's visiting with the team. We have about 70 government affairs professionals who are working hard every day around the world for 3M in-house. So whether they're based in Europe or Asia or Africa, and in Latin America, Canada.
70 in-house.
70 in-house.
And you also have, outside, like in Connecticut, I think you have Gaffney Bennett.
That's right. Good research, Jay.
Well,
yeah.
Jay is one of the legendary, iconic lobbyists in Connecticut.
That's right. If I ever have a question about Connecticut, I call Jay.
Well, you and a lot of people.
That's right.
A lot of lobbyists. So.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So you have firms like Jay's.
Correct. In the United States, and then we have firms or consultants, in other countries that we use from time to time, but none of them are like Jay.
He will like that.
That's right.
Gaffney Bennett.
Yeah, that's right.
And do you have internships here that 3M offers for aspiring people who are interested in government?
You know, so we actually have just recently been talking about that here in the office. And it's something that I think we should do, right? A lot of us here that work in the office got our start as interns. And that's really what kind of, I like to say, that keeps this town moving along, our interns, because they then grow up to be, full-fledged flying eagles.
The head of government affairs at companies like 3M.
That's right. That's right. So something actually we want to do, and we just got to figure out, how we can get that done. And there are a lot of options. We can partner with some great institutions here in town that bring in students and give them help set up these kinds of opportunities, or, kind of go one-on-one direct. So we've got to figure this out, but it's something that we really want to do.
And do you, when you look back at all the different jobs that you've had, who do you think of that were key role models or mentors for you?
Gosh.
Because you've had so many different...
There are quite a few. And, yeah. and to be honest with you, I do think about all the various managers and bosses that I've had over time. But there are a handful that still, I think, remain prominently in mind, right? Mm-hmm. So whether... And I go back to the gas station I worked in Berkeley Heights with gentleman John Cosa. And it was funny that several years ago, working on a matter, emailing with outside counsel, and I see a John Cosa on the email line, and he's just a couple blocks away at a firm, and it turns out it was John's son. And that was a really nice connection.
Oh, wow.
Great memories. But what John taught me was not just show up to work on time and get the job done, mm-hmm. no matter what the weather was like, but John used to say it's always about the corporation. And now this is his business, his gas station and mechanic shop. But he taught me, you know, that when you have a job, you've got to focus on the business. All right, so that's something I keep in mind.
I like that.
You know, Galen Reeser, my former boss at PepsiCo, he used to say often, you know, get understanding. And his point was, know what you're talking about before you talk about
before
it.
Before you talk.
Right? Get the full picture. Because, you know, the story's a little deeper than you may think. Right? Or, as I mentioned earlier, the professor, Paul Williams, at American University, who said, well, if you want to do this kind of work and be in policy and international affairs and things like that, then you've got to first cut your teeth as a lawyer, right? So a lot of these thoughts I share, right? And I share with students today. Judge on the court here, the federal circuit, Judge Jimmy Reyna, was a mentor of mine from my earliest days of law school. And Jim taught me everything I needed to know about trade law, international trade, but also about lawyering and style and a really role model for a person who had just very humble beginnings and was able to achieve incredible things. It's not easy to become a federal judge. And so I haven't connected with Jimmy in a while. I should, because he's only a couple blocks that way. You can see me pointing in all four directions right here. But, you know, some of the things that Jimmy has shared with me in those many outings for a burger that we've had since 1995, I still keep in mind today.
And you, you're active...
Actually, I shouldn't say Jimmy. I should say Judge Reyna.
Particularly the fact that you're a lawyer.
That's right.
And you have done a lot of volunteer work for the Hispanic National Bar Association. Are you still active?
That's right. You know, my work at 3M has kept me really busy in terms of my first year and two here. I'm just all in on the job. So I haven't had that much time to focus back on those things that I'm really passionate about, like the Hispanic National Bar Association and their nonprofit arm, the Legal Education Fund, where we created some great programs I'm really proud of today. So I've kind of stepped back from a lot of that just because time demands between work and getting the family settled here, you know, my two top priorities there. But but also I'm incredibly committed to even the local Hispanic Bar Association here, Hispanic Bar of D.C., great family and people that aren't just, I say, professional peers, but they've become friends or like extended family. And so I do spend quite a bit of time with them. And in fact, they've got a fundraiser coming up in early November that you've just reminded me. I need to make sure that I make my plans for that one.
Make that note on your 3M
hat. That's right.
In front
of
the Pepsi bottle, in front of the Praxair truck.
That's right.
So I'm also looking at a picture of here over here with, looks like you and your wife with President Bush and Mrs. Bush. Tell us anything about that picture?
That was in my younger days, sure. So I have that photo here in the office because with a lot of these, there's a good story behind them. And that one was particularly fun because maybe one day you'll meet my wife, but she's hilarious and incredibly charismatic and outgoing. And so we make a good tag team. Here we are. I know the kids were little and, you know, we got a babysitter and left them at home. We were over at a White House holiday party. And this was really exciting because we were going to meet the president and have a photo opportunity. And so, how many people get to do that? So it's kind of cool, right? Even I still, get excited about these kinds of things. So we're in the queue, and always when you're going to be introduced to the President of the United States, you have a military officer read your name and announce you as you're walking up.
Okay.
So we had a military officer looked at our name cards, and he practiced a couple of times with a lot of effort pronouncing our names, wanting to make sure he got the pronunciation right. And, my name's, I think, is pretty easy. It's got a couple of vowels and consonants, Omar Vargas, right? It's good, easy, right? Mm-hmm. But my wife's name is Inmaculada. And so he wanted to make sure he got that right. So he and my wife are kind of going back and forth. And as I mentioned earlier, my wife is studied Spanish literature and language. And
yes. As you did.
As I did, right?
And a minor for you, though.
A minor for me, that's right. And so my wife is also a Spanish teacher in school. And so now we're walking up, and the military officer introduces us. And, right, it's this, great voice, Mr. President, present, Omar and Inmaculada Vargas, right? And he got it right. But then the President of the United States, President George W. Bush, is a very funny guy. And so who knows Spanish as well? And
yes.
And so he returns and just effusively, right? He goes, "Oh, Inmaculada, come over here," he says in Spanish, "and good to meet you." And so my wife, decides, okay, I'm going to engage here. So she goes, if you're going to speak to me, let's do it in Spanish and pronounce it correctly. And so she had the president say it again.
And
she's saying this in Spanish to the president. And the president goes on, and he's like, okay, I'll try it again, right? And it's hilarious. I'm laughing, mortified.
So she's correcting the president's pronunciation.
She's correcting the president of the United States.
Asking him
in his pronunciation, yeah.
Pronounce her name correctly.
Correct. Correct. Who does that, right? But my lovely wife.
That is great.
It is too rich. And so if you look at that photo, right, the president, you can see he's giggling. My wife is
the
laughing.
The president is clearly laughing. I will say, I'm not sure Mrs. Bush is laughing.
No, she's not. And so that's what I found most remarkable in all of this, because I'm keeping my eye on Mrs. Bush as well, the first lady. And she is poised. She's focused on the job. And I think she gave the president this look of, I can't believe you're doing this. Well, I, in my mind, am saying to my wife, I can't believe she is doing this. But we had a very good laugh about it, and that's why that photo is one of my favorites.
Well, Omar, this has been great. We very much appreciate you sitting
sure.
down with us. It was a real pleasure, and thank you for the time.
Well, thanks a lot. Happy to do this anytime.
Yeah.
All right, there it is. What a great guy. And represented by a great firm in Connecticut, Gaffney Bennett. Our appreciation to them for this interview. So until next Monday, I don't know about this contest, but, it's too late now. We put it out there. I think the producer is nuts. But again, so the contest, 5-star rating, make a comment, screenshot, email to hello@thelobbyingshow.com. And apparently, somebody's going to win a $50 gift certificate to the restaurant of their choice. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Twitter at The Lobbying Show. And anyways, so until next Monday, have a great week.